Mr.
Yes, I believe
Greco.
So, Judge.
This is the case of Tanya Ammons against the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. Ammons.
Good morning again, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Counsel. Michael Greco on behalf of Tanya Ammons, the plaintiff appellant. This is a case where the defendant obviously is asserting that we're limited to review under Federal Rule 60B6 because of the jurisdictional order limits review to the district court's order of October 26, 2012. And the reason for that limitation was because the October 26, 2012 order was an order denying the plaintiff's Rule 59E motion to reconsider the order granting summary judgment to the defendant of March 1st, 2012.
Well, you can only file one Rule 59E motion, and we don't really care what you label subsequent motions. If they're filed outside the time for Rule 59 motions, they are regarded as Rule 60 motions, and that's what we have before us, it seems.
I put forth the case I found from 1992, and I don't believe it's been altered since then. I think it's Abs versus Foreman. There is Abs versus Sullivan, the denial of a motion to reconsider is not generally appealable separately from the judgment to which the rule
motion to reconsider. Is that cited in
your brief? It's cited in the reply, Your Honor.
Reply brief?
Yeah, that's right, Your Honor. It is adverse to us. However, I would argue that that's a general proposition. In this case, I would urge that under the Shearing Plow versus Schwartz Pharma case, which I believe is also cited just in the reply brief, that the order denying the original Rule 59E motion without prejudice and with leave to file an amended motion to reconsider.
But that doesn't affect this court's jurisdiction. If the district court wants to let you file other things, it can do so, but it doesn't change the clock for filing a notice of appeal. The clock for filing a notice of appeal depends on the date when the final judgment was entered. It depends on the date when a timely filed Rule 59 motion is resolved. But you can imagine that if we let amendments and amendments and amendments to Rule 59 motions go on, there wouldn't be a time for a notice of appeal. And the Supreme Court has made it clear that because the civil time for appeal stems from a statute, it's a jurisdictional limitation. Bowles against Russell.
Yes, Judge.
They hadn't decided that either as of 1992. So, I mean, we have to follow the law as it now is.
Understood, Your Honor.
The brief doesn't focus on why the standards of Rule 60, even after, you know, this was all put in front of you in the briefing orders and so on, I don't see why the standards of Rule 60 are even addressed in your brief, much less met.
Not in the brief. In the order of October 26, 2012, in the district court addressed it as a Rule 59E motion.
I'm just asking you, why does any of the subparts of Rule 60 apply to the October 2012 order denying the amended motion to consider?
Well, the difficulty that we have is that a Rule 60 is not an end run around Rule 59. The matters which could have been brought forth in the appeal cannot be brought forth under Rule 60B6. We can only argue that the so-called catch-all provision of Rule 60B6 provides a basis for review, and we acknowledge that's a difficulty. That the only thing I can argue is that under Rule 4A, the disposition of the motion to reconsider did not, in fact, take place on April 4th, 2012. That was a denial of the motion without prejudice. Even the court's original call for a jurisdictional memorandum acknowledges that that was a denial of without prejudice and with leave to amend. And there were not multiple amendments of the motion to reconsider. It was a single amendment of the motion to reconsider. Sometimes motion to reconsider can take months, 2, 3, or 4 months to be resolved. So that circumstance imposes on the litigants and on the court a delay, just as serial amendments to the motion to reconsider would burden the court and the parties. So that I would argue that under the Schwartz Pharma, the Shearing Plow versus Schwartz Pharma case, the rule, the interim order denying without prejudice and with leave to amend the original timely filed motion to reconsider should not be considered a disposition of the motion to reconsider. The Judge Gottschall in the district court was not then done with the motion to reconsider. She expected an amendment, and she received it. Moving to if it's a limited review, it would be very difficult, I understand, for Your Honor to take light of the circumstances. However, we submit that the two positions that we were definitely put into issue, as the district court acknowledged in the order of November 9th of 2011, the centrifuge position and the storeroom position were not subjected to a meaningful ADA interactive process, and also that the Dr. Herman, my client's psychiatrist, Dr. Herman, revised his opinion as to her limitations with regard to the working around platforms and working and operating a forklift, albeit subsequently to the original opinion. His modification should have been considered and possibly would have been revisited as part of an interactive process.
Why, if the judge is entitled to have time limits, there was any duty to consider this very late in the day opinion?
I believe that the judge, at least as of November 9th, 2011, Judge Gottschall was putting forth that the case would proceed as to available positions, that there were genuine issues of fact as to whether or not there were available positions.
Right, but then
positions.
She concludes that the two positions that are identified are positions for which Ms. Ammons is not qualified.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that was after...
Because of the medical limitations that Dr. Herman has identified, as well as her own testimony.
That's correct, Judge. And however, at that point, that was in March of 2011, the judge did have Dr. Herman's revised affidavit and information at that point. So we submit that
that's a theory that there's no date, that you could just leave the lawsuit pending long enough, then if somebody gets better, then all of a sudden the employer has violated the ADA by not rehiring them? I don't quite understand that theory.
The interactive process in this case was extremely brief, and I believe that the court did find, at least in 2011, that there were genuine issues of fact. She did ultimately find that the defendant should be accorded summary judgment, but she had found that there were genuine issues of fact, at least in November of 2011.
Those were resolved, weren't they? I mean, you just said that. They went back. It had to do with the whether the tanks were full or not, and that sort of thing.
Exactly, whether or not the plaintiff could work around the water, which that opinion was not revised. But there was a potential we submit for accommodation, even as to the.
There was no conflict. At first, the district judge thinks there's a failure to exhaust. Then she decides, well, that was wrong. Let's go back to the drawing board. Then she looks carefully at the two positions you put forward, and she says, these are not positions for which this individual is qualified, so there's no ADA violation. An employer is not required to craft a brand-new position for ADA purposes.
That's correct, and we submit that that there was error there in not considering the Dr. Herman affidavit and the modifications it made as to Ms. Ammons' limitations.
Okay.
I'll reserve rebuttal, if I may.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Christopher Murray. We're having lots of names.
I'd say no relation, but that would not be true.
Oh, okay.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Christopher Murray on behalf of the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District. We agree with Your Honor that the correct standard of review in this case is under Rule 60B, which counsel concedes is a very difficult burden. In fact, relief under Rule 60B is an extraordinary remedy and is granted only under exceptional circumstances where there is a significant probability of a substantial injustice. Also, a Rule 60B motion must be in a collateral attack of a judgment, and grounds for setting aside a judgment.
That depends, really. I mean, you know, Rule 60B is not a collateral attack in the sense that 2254 or 2255 or, you know, lots of other things are. It's filed in the original case. It's just that that's the only thing that's on the table. And you have the one-year limit for 60B 4, 5, and 6, and you've got the clerical points and so on. I think, though, the first thing you said is correct. It's not a substitute for an appeal, and you can't just trot out Rule 60B-6 and say, now we're going to talk about all the things we would have talked about if the appeal had been timely. So that far, I'm in total agreement with you. My question is, what do we do when a district court judge says something confusing, such as perhaps Judge Gottschall said when she said, well, I'm denying this without prejudice to renewal, and maybe you can come back? If she had just kept her mouth shut and thought about the motion for a longer time, then the time to appeal would have run from her disposition of the properly filed Rule 59 motion, right?
Well, the judge's order actually says, I'm denying it without prejudice, and I will give you leave to file another post-judgment motion.
What's without prejudice? What did she think she was doing? Without prejudice can't mean much if the appellate clock is ticking.
Perhaps she was thinking that the appellant could file a separate post-judgment motion under Rule 60B. The order doesn't say I'm granting you leave to file another Rule 59 motion. It just simply says it's denied without prejudice and you can file another post-judgment motion. Rule 59 is not the only avenue in which an unsuccessful plaintiff can attack a judgment. Rule 60B.
That's true, although you've just explained that if they had filed a Rule 60 motion after she entered that order, you would have been right in there saying that this is beyond the scope of Rule 60, that there's nothing so egregiously wrong with what the district court did to justify 60B6 relief or, for that matter, anything else. I'm sure you would have said that, right?
We would have. And actually, we would have said, as we're going to say here, everything that the plaintiff appellant brought up during summary judgment is the same thing they are bringing in this incorrectly labeled Rule 59 motion, which isn't proper. It's getting around Rule 59 when you do that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, Rule 59 has no purpose.
So what about these two jobs, the centrifuge job and the storeroom job? If we were reviewing all the way back to the merits order, and we very well may not be, but if we were, just for the sake of argument, is the record absolutely clear that the necessary positions for those jobs, the necessary qualifications and demands of those jobs are beyond the scope of the doctor's recommendation?
Well, the doctor's recommendations are certainly incompatible with the essential functions of both positions. As a preliminary point, there's no explanation in appellant's brief as to what the essential functions are of either position or how, given the psychiatrist's significant medical restrictions, she could be able to perform those functions. So we believe they've even waived the right to argue that. But getting to the substance of the argument.
Don't waive it too quickly. I mean, what he said is she can't do either one, right?
I believe they are maintaining they could perform the essential functions.
That's not what the doctor said.
The doctor gave medical restrictions, and the issue was, given these restrictions, could the appellant perform the essential functions of either position?
For example, the centrifuge was empty.
Right. It was a vacant position. Right. And
if there's no water, I mean, if there are no platform, there was some issue about water, no more than 2 feet of water.
Yeah, I can get into expressly what the restrictions are that relate to these two positions. Regarding the centrifuge position, she could not work near platforms, which the psychiatrist defined as a flat surface area of higher elevation where one could potentially lean over and fall. She could not operate power tools and equipment. She could not work near tanks of water 2 feet deep or deeper, and she could not climb ladders. So
this is all based on the medication she was taking and the
her psychiatric
side
condition.
Effects.
Her psychiatric condition.
And her psych, both?
The psychiatrist, I don't think drew a distinction that it was because of any medicine she was taking. I think he referred generally to it, her being her psychiatric condition. So regarding the centrifuge position, the summary judgment record is clear as to platforms were an essential function of that position. There were photographs submitted of countless platforms where one could potentially lean over and fall. The supervisor of the position testified by affidavit that working near these platforms is unavoidable. It's a daily occurrence, and there's only one employee assigned to this particular position. And also, the centrifuge building closed shortly after the transfer was made to the centrifuge position. So after it was closed, you had an additional hurdle because the appellant would have had to work near tanks of water more than 2 feet deep, would have had to climb ladders. The storeroom position, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
And that's the ladders, too. I know your time is getting, the storeroom position required ladders as well, right?
Definitely. We're talking about storage shelves that run from floor to ceiling that the laborer would have to climb. And again, it's only one laborer assigned to this position. The laborer would have to climb, whether it's for purposes of dusting, replacing stock, in order to do those functions. Also, we're talking about power tools for the storeroom, operating a forklift truck, a motorized pallet stacker, an overhead crane. In fact, as to the forklift truck, to show how essential it was, the laborer was trained every other year and certified how to operate one. And finally, there's a loading dock, which contains platforms that the laborer would be expected to come help unload supplies from a truck pulling into the loading dock. So these are all essential functions that management determined were essential to both positions. To eliminate any of these functions would fundamentally change the nature of the job. We'd have to get another.
How long had she worked on that job?
And she hadn't worked in either of these two positions. She was a laborer since 1986, working in a different section that she didn't identify as a reasonable accommodation. So we'd essentially have to get another laborer to pick up the shortfall for her inability to do these tasks. The ADA only requires that an employer provide a reasonable accommodation, and here the accommodations identified by the appellant were not reasonable. They were an undue hardship on the district because we would have had to remove essential functions to both positions. I would like to make a comment regarding what Your Honor called a late in the day opinion, which was the psychiatrist's
later opinion.
Right. It's a 2010 letter, and the district court thought what Your Honor did, that it was late in the day. The transfers had already been made several years earlier, so it couldn't have factored into any decision-making process. But also, there's the additional problem is the substance of that letter contradicts the psychiatrist's deposition testimony. The psychiatrist testified at his deposition, these original restrictions, working near platforms, working near tanks of water, climbing ladders, operating power tools, are they still necessary for the appellant to return to work? And he said yes. And he was asked what would happen if she had to do these functions. He testified at his deposition she would be unable to do it. We even asked him about certain functions, like operating a forklift truck. If she had never done that before and the district trained her on how to operate one, he categorically stated she would fail the training. She would be unable to do it. So there's a couple of real serious evidentiary problems with this late-in-the-day letter, and we believe the district court was correct in and disregarding it. The final issue I'd like to bring to the court's attention, it's an alternative reason why the district court's ruling should be upheld, and that is these transfers are discrete employment acts that occurred after the appellant filed her one and only EEOC charge. And if you look at the charge says the district won't bring me back to work and accommodate my restrictions. The district could have hypothetically, say there was a position out there, accommodated plaintiff, and put her in a position other than one of the two positions, storm or centrifuge, and fulfilling the underlying charge, but not these transfers, which is why they're separate and discrete acts. So that's an additional reason why the judgment should be upheld. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further? I think, again, you have about 30 seconds, Mr. Greco.
Thank you, Your Honor. We submit that the deposition testimony was not so incompatible with the letter that Dr. Herman testified. He had removed the platform's restriction and stated that that Ms. Ammons could drive a forklift. I believe that that was after the deposition as well. We submit that with the removal of the platform's restriction and the testimony that she could drive a forklift, there was a reasonable accommodation available in the storeroom, even if it potentially someone else might have to use a ladder once in a while. But presumably, much of the tasks could have been accomplished with those restrictions modified. As far as the Rule 60B issue, we submit that Mr. Murray has conceded everybody before Judge Gottschall was operating under the presumption that the disposition on October 26, 2012 was of a Rule 59E motion. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.